Welcome back, ladies, gentlemen, and dead things of all ages. The wait is over. It is finally time for Penny Dreadful Season 3. Tonight, we are covering the premiere episode entitled The Day Tennyson Died. This is a No Shit Network podcast. I'm your host, Steve.
I'm your host, Paul.
And I am your host, Em.
Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download and a 30-day free trial at www.audibletrial.com/noship. Over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. That's www.audibletrial.com/noship, N-O-S-H-I-P.
And, you know, if you want to go to Audible and check it out, my recommendation, if you're wanting to get deeper knowledge about Victorian Britain, is to try out the Victorian Britain Great Courses through Audible. That's actually what I'm listening to right now. I'm about 4 hours in. I had listened to this a little bit last season, too, but I'm going to try to finish it this time.
Okay, before we get into it, what did you guys think?
Terrible. Yeah. Worst show I've ever seen. Yeah. Can't believe we're podcasting on it again. Just kidding. It was fucking amazing. I mean, it came out and punched you right in the nuts. It was awesome.
Can't say I had that experience. I did not get the nut punch.
Do you believe in nut punching, Mr. Chandler?
Yeah, this was a great opening episode. I'm really, really excited for this season.
This was flawless. I mean, when the Mortal Kombat guy says flawless victory, this is what he's talking about. There wasn't an off note. There wasn't any bad acting. The cinematography was just spot on. It's propulsive. It's just like it keeps going. I mean, it's amazing how much information, character development, and story development that they were able to cram into an hour.
Yeah, they weren't wasting any time at all. They were like, we have a mission, let's do it.
I think that was my favorite thing about it, was that it's a step above, it's a little bit of a notch above season one and two, in the sense that you're getting all of that information that you want. There's no, it's not holding too much back. It's just like bam, 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 bam. So that just means that there's huge, huge, big things for this season. I'm excited.
You're so excited he whispered at people. That's pretty exciting.
I had to do something different because I'm sitting here talking about how good it is and getting louder and louder, so I just decided to go the opposite way.
I know it's a setup episode, but I very close to feeling like that this is my favorite episode of the entire series so far.
Pretty close to it, although this last year's season finale was pretty epic. This one, maybe because we were jonesing. We were like Dr. Frankenstein needing a fix, and they gave us like some good shit, you know?
I have had sores on my lips for the last couple of weeks waiting for this. But I did watch the last 10 minutes of Verbis Diablo before we podcasted, just to kind of get refreshed. And that scene where Vanessa and the puppets start talking at each other still gives you the chills. So
it's so good.
All right, so The Day Tennyson Died, which is October 6th, 1892. He died at the age of 83. This episode was written by John Logan and directed by Damon Thomas. So we open with Vanessa alone in the Murray estate. And this place and her are in a very sad, sorry state of affairs. We've got mail coming through, just piling up. Mm-hmm. There's sheets over all the furniture. There's cobwebs, half-eaten food and cigarette butts, perpetual bed hair.
I mean, she doesn't smoke tobacco.
Oh, so she just gets high as a kite then.
Yeah.
Yep, wow. That's it. If I had the devil rattling around in my head, I'd probably do the same thing a lot.
I mean, she had an ashtray full. I don't know that, you know, when you're feeling depressed, I'm not sure if that's the right thing to do. Smoke a lot of pot.
No, probably not, but at least it passed the time.
Well, I mean,
I thought it was the doctor's house at first. It looked so bad. I was like, man, you know, this is a junkie's home. And then you see her and it's like, oh, fuck. Vanessa, no. No.
Bad Vanessa. Bad. So some good Samaritan is delivering food. Either that or she has paid for a service to deliver food. Mm-hmm. And she eats and drinks this stuff like she's feral. I mean, you can hear her swallowing. She's just tearing the chunks off of the bread.
You certainly can hear it, yes.
M has misophonia. Look it up. So Ferdinand Lyle comes to visit, and he's knocking on the door. And, you know, she's trying to ignore it. And I'm assuming this is the one who's giving her the food, I think.
I think she's ordered it.
You think she ordered it?
Yeah, I feel like she's ordered it.
I guess it does kind of look like a parcel that's been set up by somebody. Like, they just leave it outside.
Like the milkman.
I mean, I guess it's October in London, so it's okay just to drink milk that hasn't been refrigerated in an icebox. But so Lyle comes to visit, and he's knocking on the door, threatening to just keep knocking until his knuckles bleed. So she finally lets him in, and he's right away with the jokes. He's like, I love what you've done with the place. So he tells her of Tennyson's death. That's why the bells are ringing. And he tells her about a mental doctor who saved his life, and he goes into the whole spiel about that and, you know, how he is who he is, resplendently so, because of this woman. And he leaves her card, and he makes an says he's going to make an appointment for her. And then again, he says, you might want to, you know, fix up your hair. And she goes over and gives him a hug. She doesn't say anything in this scene. We actually don't get any utterance from Vanessa Ives until she gets to Dr. Seward's office.
If we all could be like Lyle, because first of all, he delivers like the perfect joke at a time like when her place is all a mess and he says, I like what you've done with the place. I think most people would just like act like they don't see it, you know? And, you know, humor, I think he started the healing process for her just by bringing in humor. And then,
absolutely.
And then when she goes and lays on his lap and he still puts his hand on her hair, I would have been like, you know, you need a bath. Like, just lightly petting
her.
I'm sure
she smelled fantastic. Yeah.
Especially since he's putting down a little handkerchief just so he can sit on a chair.
Right.
You know? And
Well, he makes you love his character even more because it really shows that, you know, for as prim and proper as he is, he's really turned out to be a good friend.
Yeah.
And
glad he's still around.
If everybody in the world had a friend as good as him, think about how much better of a place this whole fucking world would be. You know, if everybody had somebody like him in their lives. And I think this really, to me, this scene strikes at the core of the show. What makes it such a good show is because there's this compassion with the core characters, this friendship and this loyalty that they have towards each other, even when they're in far-flung places. So now we go to the New Mexico territories, and Bartholomew Rusk and his junior assistant, whose name I don't recall, and I looked up on IMDb and it's not there.
Yeah, it's just junior inspector, isn't it?
It just says junior inspector. Junior. So we'll just call him Junior. So Bartholomew Rusk and Junior discuss their dim view of America, a whole country built on skeletons.
So, they're just bitter that they lost the colony.
Yeah. Call the Wambulance to follow that train. So they excuse themselves from Ethan's presence to go get some tea in what's the name of the cart in the train? The car in the train where you go get food? The food car?
The refreshment car. I don't know.
the soda stand car. All right, so they go there to get some tea, and Ethan is surrounded by no-nonsense marshals, rough-looking characters, hundreds of miles of nothing, and Hecate. So
everybody's all dressed in black and she's wearing all white.
Yeah. I mean, they've got, you know, they're blacks and dark browns. They're all dusty and everything. And this woman looks like she just got out of the boudoir, if that would be the right way to put it. I mean, she's just prim, proper, like perfectly clean. So the bartender rustles up some tea and learns that Ethan has butchered a lot of people and ate a fair number of them. I have to point out that these two are the only people on that train car that are getting tea. Everybody else has whiskey. I guarantee it.
Well,
I mean,
you know, America.
So the rough looking posse make their move, and after the lead guy looks at his timepiece and figures out that it's time to do this, and they shoot everybody in both cars in the face, except for a defenseless female. So
which we know they should have shot her first.
Yeah. I don't know if that would have been successful though.
No, yeah, I know, right?
It's almost like you're almost hoping for a scene where he does try to shoot her so we can see some sort of cool magic happen. And
she might be.
She just melts into the train.
Yeah, she's just more worried about blowing her cover at this point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is Ethan's welcoming party. So they knock him out and they ride off with him. And both Rusk and Hecate both look really disappointed. But I have to say, she looks disappointed because her plans have been thwarted. But Rusk looks determined more than anything else.
Well, there was that nice shot out the window where at first, like when I saw it, I thought it was like some kind of weird bottle brush that had like red blooms on it, or sage brush or something that had red blooms. But it was actually blood on the window that was like superimposed over the sage brush or something like that. So I realized I was not seeing what I thought I was seeing. But, but you know, when you look at her expression, when she's looking out the window, you could read it as disappointment. But she's also like trying to keep an eye on like what direction Ethan's going. You know, she's tagging him because she's going to follow, I think.
Yeah, because I'm sure she's got some sort of means of getting to where he's going or following him to where she's not going to be seen. I mean, she was taking...
Yeah, Satan's radar.
Yeah. I mean, this chick can probably fly, you know, for all we know.
Yeah.
I mean, shit. She's probably got all the powers that her mom had, plus some, because she survived it all. So now she's Satan's favorite child at this point.
It's almost like she's the only one. Didn't all the rest of them die but her?
Yeah.
So she's free. She's free range to
do
whatever.
Yeah, there could be some other covens that weren't connected to her out there. But
And she would just go and commandeer them. You know, she's just like, hey, I'm in town, so your coven's mine. And we're going to go hunt this werewolf.
Coven of witches.
So we find Malcolm Murray in Zanzibar, German East Africa. In the background, you can hear the Muslim call to prayer, and we get a voiceover of him telling how he buried Simbene without any kind of real fanfare or anything. He took him back to the mountains where he was from.
So he's writing a letter to Vanessa, right?
Yeah, yeah. This is the contents.
And it's also October 6, 1892.
I think this whole episode happens inside that day, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Mm-hmm.
So he drinks in an Indiana Jones bar, and he laments. I mean, seriously,
it reminded me of Indiana Jones. I was waiting for a monkey eating
for
dates.
Sure.
Yeah, there was a little monkey hopping around, or some little animal hopping around somewhere.
Have Sala come in and sit next to him. You know, maybe sing a song.
I am the monarch of the sea.
Of the sea.
So he's lamenting the state of Africa, and he makes plans to leave. He wants to be quit of the place. It's lost all its romance. It's lost all its luster for him. So he exits the bar, and he's accosted by a woman carrying a child, supposedly, who says he can fuck her anywhere he wants to. And she calls him John Bull. And M looked this up. And what does this mean?
It's like their version or their same concept of a national personification like we have for Uncle Sam. So,
interesting.
But so like I don't know if other countries would call us Uncle Sam. Don't we usually get called like G.I. Joe or something like that?
Or Cowboy.
Yeah, G.I. Joe, Uncle Sam. I'm sure there's a few of them now. Bastards.
But it seems to be that's about the same equivalent. John Bull, Uncle Sam.
So she pulls a gun and says that, you know, instead of him fucking her, maybe she'll let them fuck him, meaning all the guys that followed him out from the bar. Ouch.
Yeah, it's pretty bad.
This is why you don't give money to people who beg for it on the street, by the way, because they
no
have
eye
guns
contact.
And they're trying to get other people to fuck you. This is a proven fact.
It's not for
it
booze.
Is not.
It's for nope.
A mysterious Native American man hits her right between the eyes with a dagger, and then he and Malcolm make short work of these chumps in a pretty brutal and bloody fashion, though, because they both know how to fight.
Quick.
And then this guy comes over and scalps one of the attackers. And they don't hold back. You just hear that sawing sound.
Oh, yeah. It was
a great thick scalp, too. Yeah. There was a lot of meat under that.
Yeah, he wasn't going for that thin layer and then the hair. He just said, right here at the forehead, let's do it. And he holds it up and he says, old traditions die hard, don't they, Sir Malcolm? And so this is our introduction to... we don't know his name yet, but the actor's name is Wes Studi, and you would probably remember him most from Last of the Mohicans and Dances with Wolves, but he's been in a ton of stuff. So now, did you guys want to say anything else about that scene?
Well, it's cool because, you know, we don't know what's going to happen, but you hope that this is his new sidekick. You know, like, he knows Malcolm Merlyn, so it gave
Malcolm
us a little bit
Merlyn?
Of a taste of what was coming. Or, you know what I mean, different show. Sorry. It's another Merlyn, though. Sorry. Or another Malcolm.
It's the Merlyn
show. Totally different show I watched like 30 minutes before.
What show is
this?
That?
It's Flash. Okay. It's one of the people from The Flash, yeah.
So anyway, you were... Go.
But it was a nice taste because, you know, without Simbene, he seemed kind of down in the dumps. So I was hoping that, you know, we might have... his new sidekick that'll come and save him when gangs of dudes are trying to rape him.
I think Malcolm Murray is more his sidekick. Because this guy's demanding things out of him.
Yeah.
In the next scene, we go to JC. We catch up with John Clare. And we find out that he, in fact, did not go to the North Pole to go get his copy of Immortals at the Heart of Winter signed by the band. He's actually still stuck in this boat, and it's locked in ice. And this is a shitty situation. The crew...
Yeah, whose idea was to drive a wooden boat into an ice field? Bad yeah. Captain.
Was it all wooden?
Yeah, it looked all wooden. Because at one point, remember, the ice locks up even more, and the whole bow snaps. It sounds like wood cracking.
Is it maybe a combo? Because I think that's a pretty big boat.
There was some steel on it, but I think it was mostly like
iron, actually. Or iron. A lot of iron was used in boat making at that time.
Oh, I'm going to have to go back and check. Like... Either way, it was a bad idea. Yeah.
So the crew is starving, and they're considering actually eating their dead crewmates, who they have stacked up on the deck. And so as they go back and forth between this, JC starts singing a song to himself, and he has a flashback from his former life as a husband and a father. And you get to see him looking in the mirror and see what he looked like. And he actually looks better now, I think, just saying. Maybe without the puzzle stuff on the side of his head, but...
Yeah, you know, without the massive scars and the pale skin.
Say the puzzle stuff?
Yeah, it looks like a jigsaw puzzle on the side of his head. Which I've always thought that.
Yeah, I don't know if it's because I was watching it on a different device, but I felt like I really could see it more than I normally could, or that I could before. Like, it was more noticeable. I don't know if we got more of a close-up. But
yeah, it was cool definitely seeing him with his family, too. Like, oh, shit, he's getting, like, some real memory.
Yeah,
like,
this is the first time we've seen him get some memory. And it's a weird memory because it's almost like he's looking back at himself. Like, the personification in his memory is aware of him observing,
yeah,
which is creepy.
So this means big things going forward, because this means that, you know, Lily / Brona can probably start to have a lot more recall of... You know, stuff that's gone on in the past in her life, you know, we don't really know. It's indeterminate how much she actually has had up until now, but we won't talk too much about her since she's not even in this episode. But
God, though, I can't wait till they are. I mean, as fantastic as our storylines are now, there's no telling what those two crazy bastards are
doing. They always seem to wait to drop Dorian on us. Like, it's never right away.
Mm-hmm.
The D-bomb. So, you know, the crew wants to kill this child because they know he's not long for the world and they want to eat him. They're starving. Understandable. So he goes over and he shows a kindness to the child and asks the captain how long he's going to be able to live. And he says, maybe a few days. So he kills him out of mercy and wishes them luck and starts to walk home. Now that
they ask him, where are you going? He's like, I'm going home. This is annoying.
I'm not a fan of CGI breath in cold weather, but I wonder if it's necessary if you got to have John Clare / Caliban where he doesn't have the breath. It's probably easier to add the CGI breath than it is to take it away, maybe.
That's a really good point.
Yeah, there's no telling.
Yeah, because that makes a lot of sense because, I mean, you can make a room as cold as you need to, you know, and that would probably actually be less expensive than CGI. I don't know. CGI is pretty widespread nowadays, but... If you did that and then you had to have somebody who didn't have breath, that would be a problem. And then,
So, of course, he's leaving to actually go home, huh? We're going to get his homecoming to his wife and kids.
That's what I'm assuming. Yeah.
Depending on what, you know, what developed with that family. How did he die?
Yeah, the kids would be grown.
To begin with. And but yeah, it's a long, long walk.
Yeah. And there might not be ice the whole way. I don't
think there will.
You're going to do some swimming.
Hey, I wonder how far, like, into the Arctic they were. Like, is he going to have to come into Siberia, down? I mean, what? I don't even know. I didn't look at a globe, so I'm not sure how that landmass works.
Well, Norway. He's going to
pass through Kattegat and then come
yeah,
down.
Norway and Sweden's right there. He could come down that way, I guess.
That'd be cool
if
we can get some scenes of that.
Yes.
So back in Zanzibar, the Indian mystery man tells him that he missed him. He's talking to Malcolm Murray, that he missed him in London and that he's been waiting for him to come back from the interior here in Africa. And Murray's like, well, how did you know that I wouldn't die out there? And he's like, you can't die until you serve your purpose. And what purpose is that? To fight the great demons of earth and sky until you are dead. That is pretty awesome. If that's all you did with your life, it would be a worthy life. The Great Demons of Earth and Sky.
Well, it's very captivating. You know, it's like he's trying to get him to help him, and then he drops that, so he knows what he's been up to already, too. So it's like, how does he know that he's already been fighting demons and stuff?
And why is he so sure that this is his destiny? Like, what kind of spiritual connection does he have? And with what?
Who is he? I know, it's exciting.
He tells him that he demands that Murray come with him to America to help Ethan Chandler. And at this point, he reveals his name, which is Kaiutane. I hope I'm not mangling that too much.
Kaiutane.
All right. Either way. And so they have like a little mini discussion about him saying, he who is almost my son. And then he references it again, and he says, we have to go help our son. So both of these guys have been a father figure to Ethan in some way, shape, or form. We've obviously seen Murray and Ethan's relationship, but the nature of the relationship between Kaiutane and Chandler is unknown to us at some point. We know that he's from the New Mexico territories, but we don't know what's up with that.
Like, maybe he was one of the first people that found him after he wolfed out and helped him, or there's no telling. Or he's the guy that made him that way. I mean, you never know. He could be a villain, but I doubt it. I hope not.
Yeah, I doubt it. I don't get that villain vibe from him.
He claims to be almost his father, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Because I always imagine Ethan's dad being like the King Wolf. You know what I mean? Like the big bad of his family. Because now you know his dad's sending not just lawmen after him. Those are straight up villains to kill. So he's like a criminal, you know? So
I think I've always thought the same thing about his dad, but I was wondering, because I know we haven't gotten to that scene yet, but because we're talking about this, when they say they're bringing him to his dad and Ethan says, good luck. I mean, wouldn't they be prepared for him to wolf out? Because if his dad knows of it, wouldn't he have like prepared them for that fact?
You would think, but at the same time, his dad might be so evil that he wants him to keep killing. So maybe he just gives in to it and becomes
he's still got to make it home if he wants him there.
Yeah,
right?
I know, right? I guess.
This could
also
be a guarded secret as well. So maybe he's Ethan's assuming that these guys don't know. And that's why he says in this scene, you know, we're taking you home. And he's like, good luck. Because he knows that something's going to happen between then, now, and then that's not going to turn out so well for those guys.
Yes, I can't wait again to see who his dad is and mysteries revealed. Finally.
So, in the next scene, a tall, dark, and handsome man walks the streets of London getting called a slew of racial epithets.
That seems so impolite even for those times, don't you think? Like, do people just...
I mean,
I guess I just can't imagine that behavior.
Yeah, it's hard nowadays, but I think back then it was pretty easy to throw those things out there. You know, turn of the century almost, everything else that had been going on, slavery, you know. Oh, no, I guess slavery had been abolished by then, but still, it's not far from being around at the time. So it was a bit rude and a bit brash, but it's supposed to be. You know, it's kind of like a good reminder, like even in Django, where it's like in your face. If you're going to do it, might as well make it to where it pulls that emotion out of you. You know, so you want to kind of come really strong with it. Hopefully it's not every episode, but it was very effective in this one. It was like, damn, you know, and he just walks and ignores it, you know, and takes it in stride.
He gets called a wog twice in this episode, once by one of the hecklers on the street and another time by Frankenstein. And I think wog is a slang term for Indian people in England. And this lady who's throwing piss and shit out of her window at him and telling him to go back to Calcutta. I mean, that's pretty harsh. But I mean, he keeps a stiff upper lip and just keeps walking.
He's cataloging it, though.
Oh, yeah. All those people are going to pay.
Yeah.
When Mr. Hyde comes out, they're dead. So he goes into a very familiar stairwell filled with, you know, the dregs and wretches of society that tend to live there. And obviously he's going to see Victor. And this turns out to be Dr. Jekyll. So here we have a really cool spin on the Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde thing going on right here. I would not have guessed that like right off the bat, because looking from the previews, I thought that Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde was going to be that crazy guy with the goofy hair following Vanessa.
I thought
around.
That was Hyde. Yeah.
Or, yeah.
Yeah. Our preview podcast, we were way off. There was nothing we predicted that was.
Well, it's intentionally, you know, diverting us down you know, dead end paths. So Victor is looking rough, man.
Whoa, rough.
We didn't see Vicky looking this rough last season. He's bad. He is bad off.
Yeah, him and Vanessa could have had like a runway competition on who looked the shittiest. You know, like, oh, I look shittier. It's like, well, you might.
Let's lock ourselves in the Murray estate and see who can give less of a fuck about our hygiene, our appearance, and our just general welfare.
Yeah.
So this, just by the way, this actor is Shahzad Latif is his name. And I looked him up on the IMDb page. And I didn't know anything that he's been in. I think he's big in England. So, you know, like everything was English. So it wasn't anything that I recognized. But so Jekyll sits down to talk with Frankenstein and they have some tea and he sees the track marks. And this is where Victor starts to tell him about his success with the old work, letting us know that these guys have a long past together and that they tried to do this stuff before and so on and so forth. And then Victor unfolds a tale that is better suited to Black Midnight.
Yeah. I love the scene because we do get a little background and then they kind of place Hyde and him in this cool little bubble in their past, you know, like Dr. Frankenstein and Dr. Jekyll together, you know, it was like, oh, it's so genius to have them together because it's two scientists experimenting and feeding off each other. It was beautifully done.
So our next scene, Vanessa visits the doctor, Dr. Seward. Ives is visibly taken back by the resemblance of Dr. Seward to Joan Clayton, the cut wife. And she mentions this, and I guess that this Dr. Seward actually comes from that family. But she doesn't really make a big deal out of that. She's just, maybe she's gotten this before. I don't know. But Vanessa seems to take it in stride, almost like she realizes the supernatural import of that. She just goes, okay, well, one of these, somebody from this family is always going to be looking out for me, basically.
Yeah, she seemed invigorated by it, I thought.
She did, yeah. It was almost like she was, it put a smile on her face, kind of. She was like, oh, cool. And what I really liked about what Dr. Seward said at the beginning was that you're not bad, you're not unworthy, you're just ill, which is, it's really important for people who are suffering like that to hear, because you have all those thoughts of being unworthy.
Right.
And, you know, and I think from a modern day doctor perspective, somebody would diagnose Ives with depression right off the bat, you know?
Absolutely.
So we get a really cool back and forth between these two women about why she would be a good patient and what she sees in her. And it was really cool because the tide kind of turns. So at first Seward has the upper hand, then Ives has the upper hand, and they just go back and forth with it. So Seward nails Vanessa's problem, at least the psychological one, and gives her homework to do and says, do something new. And the one little tiny eensy teensy bit of little research I did for this is that she calls herself an alienist, which an alienist, I guess, is just an archaic term for a psychologist or a psychiatrist. This is what they used to call them now. The people who are referred to as alienists nowadays actually use psychology to defend people in criminal cases, apparently.
Oh, wow.
So it's not something that's, you know, but what was important was that she was bringing it up because this is a sort of like unrecognized science. It's not totally legit yet in the eyes of the world, but it's obviously the way of the future.
Yeah, starting to take hold.
Another thing that's important is that her last name, Seward, Dr. John Seward from Bram Stoker's Dracula, was the doctor in the asylum. In fact, Renfield was a patient.
Interesting.
And he was also, and Dr. John Seward was also a someone who wanted Lucy Westenra's hand in marriage. She turned him down, but he was still there to help try to fight for her life, and then later Mina Murray's.
Yeah, I didn't even pick that up. It's been a long time since I've read that Dracula, but that's pretty cool how they like mix it all in.
I read it like a year and a half ago, and I didn't even pick it up. That's
well,
good.
I typed Seward and Victorian literature into Google, and then boom.
Ah, okay, you cheated. I gotcha.
Whatever.
Still got me there where you didn't get there. So
oh,
that's right. Snap.
So Victor shows off his lab to Jekyll, the House of Pain.
I'll wait till later on that. I looked that up too.
Oh, I'll help you out here. It's a rap band from the early 90s.
Yeah, from the 90s.
They had a song called Jump Around.
All that comes up at first when you type that into Google, which is annoying.
So Jekyll is upset that Victor has not communicated with him for 5 years. Apparently these guys were really close friends and he just kind of cut him off. And Victor wants Jekyll to help him kill Lily. And this is where Jekyll says, I'm no killer. And he's like, really? And then Victor kind of gives us some insight into Jekyll's psyche and talks about how that's strange that you would say you're not a killer, because I'm pretty sure you would have killed any of those boys that were tormenting you while we were at school and you had their list, a list of their names and all the stuff you were going to do to them. Yeah, the murder list. And so
the lady with the chamber pots on that list now.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. She's dead. I think she was in a previous episode anyway, saying something to Victor. I'm not sure.
Something fucking rude.
She's somebody on the set's grandmother.
That's Miss Parker. Yeah.
Don't mind her. So, but this is the essence of Jekyll's work, the chemical neurological control over the beast within. So he has found a way to tame that side of him, to make him to where he doesn't want to kill that, I guess, the Mr. Hyde version of him.
Love it. Which he's probably on now. That's why he didn't yell anything at that woman when she threw piss at him.
Yeah. You'd have to have that on not to do that.
Man, you're not kidding. Get pee-pee on me? Oh, it's on.
You know it's not just pee-pee. It's poop-laden pee-pee. It's mixed in.
Yeah. Thank God for indoor plumbing.
So now it's Victor's turn. Jekyll calls him a romantic and kind of berates him for being this, you know, romantic little pie-in-the-sky guy who thought that his whole life was going to end up, or wanted his whole life to end up, like a storybook romance. And he says, he kind of ups the ante on him and says, okay, instead of killing her, what if I could make her as she was? What if I could tame her, make her a purring kitten in your lap? And Victor can't resist this. He's like, yes, I want it. Can you do that? Let's do that. You know, that would be what I would want. And he's like, all right, let's do it. You know, and he gets them all jazzed up for the challenge. And he's like, I'm going to show you my laboratory. You're going to come over and, you know, see my miracles and stuff like that. And then we're going to make this happen. But Victor's pretty adamant. And he says, okay, hear me out. If this fails, we're going to have to destroy her utterly. How they would actually go about doing that, I have no idea, because...
No, because you got to take out Dorian, too.
Know, yeah, exactly. You have to take out Dorian, too, and you've already, just putting him aside just for a second, he's shot her point blank, and nothing happened. She just looked at him and was like, is that all you got? Mm-hmm.
I think you'd have to burn her, maybe.
Yeah.
So do you think he's...
Chop her up into bits.
You think he's going to have to make more creations just so he can figure out how to kill them?
I hope so, because those creations are fun. And they keep... Yeah, they keep turning on him, and now they're her army. Like, oh, I'll make more.
Well, him and John Clare are kind of cool now. Kind of. So maybe he could get John Clare to help out with that. I don't know.
Well, that's who I think is going to have to get involved. You know, like... It just makes sense to me. That's his yang. Mm-hmm. You know, like, that's who's going to have to fight her, hold her down, because he's strong enough. He's her equal, you know, so it would have to get that, or Dr. Jekyll, maybe. I don't know. I mean, there's so many avenues this show could go that it's, who knows? Who knows, you know?
And, you know, if you become too much of a threat to Ives at this point, Dracula's going to take you out. So there's that. So she's kind of like protected status at this point.
I get like the biggest grin on my face when I think about Dracula in this show. I don't know why. It's awesome.
So Ives is followed by some shady characters, and she buys a death ribbon from a pasty, creepy kid. And she ends up visiting a natural history museum.
Okay. She just decides to ignore the fact that he called her beloved.
Yeah.
Now, I was wondering if... I know you're supposed to make that connection, especially after you watch the episode a second time, because these people are obviously working for Dracula, and that's his... Ives is his beloved, because he's fighting with his brother over her. Mm-hmm. So...
She could be disoriented. I mean, she's... got sunlight now in her face that she's not used to.
Well,
I don't know.
That, and she's kind of going through the motions of feeling kind of crazy, so maybe she second guesses that she even heard it.
Probably, you know? True.
But could this been a line from one of Tennyson's poems, perhaps?
Possibly.
And that's why she doesn't really think too much of it, because he is selling death ribbons for the poet.
Mm-hmm. And it's a child. But I would be freaked out personally. But I have, you know.
She's been through a lot of shit. She has some.
I would have moved from England if I had been in her shoes. It would have been like, I'm going far, far away.
So she visits a natural history museum, and she takes a good gander at a wolf. And then she finally looks at some, she settles to look at some scorpions. And I, you know, when she was staring at the wolf, I was thinking how goofy it would be if the wolf like had Ethan's voice and it was like, hey, Vanessa, what's up?
Yeah. They communicate through the dead wolf.
Its mouth moves just a little bit. It's barely animated. So the director of zoological studies, Dr. Alexander Sweet, introduces himself and starts talking about the various animals there and starts talking about scorpions and their sex and the whole nine yards. And he finds out that she's actually touched scorpions before, but not because she's a taxidermist or not because she is into or she's not a zoologist either. And she doesn't tell him what she does or how this came about. So he's intrigued and he waxes euphorically about the marvels of the animal kingdom and all of the things that are visible to us if we would only stop and look and wonder. And she asks what his favorites are. And he says, well, I'm not really supposed to have them, but mostly the unloved ones, the unvisited ones, the cases that get dusty and ignored, all the broken and shunned creatures.
I half expected Ives to be like, I love you. You know, like, because it was a pretty touching moment. It was nice to see her kind of connect with someone.
I was thinking it, for sure. I was loving him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
Friends.
Yeah.
So, I mean, what do you guys think of this guy? First of all, I do want to point out that he did really emphasize the, albinism of that scorpion being bloodless. And then you've got the vampires, her bloodless. And
how dangerous that is. It's a signal from nature saying danger.
Right.
Yeah.
So I don't know if we're supposed to think that he could be Dracula because of that.
But I didn't even think about
it
that.
It could be a red herring. Because after I looked up House of Pain, and that's actually from the island of Dr. Moreau.
Yeah. You think they might be trying to pull that in here too?
That's not written. That's not published until 1896. So, yeah, I do think so.
That'd be, man, you want to talk about pulling in from, this would be the melting pot season. We're just going to throw everybody in. That would be pretty cool.
Well, there's the army that you need to fight Lily / Brona or perhaps Dracula and his minions.
Yeah, but Dr. Moreau wasn't good to them, though.
Yeah.
He was brutal. I've read the book. He was really brutal.
I mean, there was a lot of.
Yeah. He would send them to the House of Pain to train them.
Yeah.
You know, and then they revolt on him.
But it would be too much to have that and to have Victor calling his laboratory the House of Pain. And then, you know.
Well, it could be foreshadowing. I'm not saying this is who that guy is, but it would be interesting if this is an introduction of a character that's going to have more.
Like in future seasons?
Yeah. And like he gets interrupted because there's something going on with a tiger.
Yeah, it would be pretty cool.
It's probably not going anywhere, but I just throw it out there because it's fun to do so.
Yeah. And if any show could pull it off, I mean, at this point, I think Penny Dreadful could.
Or he could just be Dracula.
Yeah, I mean, I cannot wait to see Dracula. They'll probably stretch it out to like episode 5, but I can't wait.
I think it's awesome they didn't show it.
Yeah, I hope.
I know.
I hope it's like they don't either don't show it, or if they finally do, it's way better than Dorian's picture.
This guy needs to be like 10 foot tall with just brimstone eyes and blood dripping off his fangs. I mean, like really scary.
And have a hologram like Snoke.
Snoke is not scary. So. This at the end of this scene, there's a cool little trick, or at least I thought it was a trick. And he's Sweet is interrupted by an assistant that is telling him, like Em said, about the tiger. Mm-hmm. And he goes to introduce this assistant to Ives, and he turns and looks at her, and his face goes blank. Now we know it's because he forgot her name, and he feels bad about it. But for a split second, you think it's that old TV or movie trick where you turn around to introduce somebody to the person and she's gone. But she's still there.
Yeah.
She's still there. Uh-huh. So I thought that was neat. And I think it has something to do with he was just talking about the dusty and ignored, the broken and shunned creatures. And then he forgets her name. So there's a connection there between the two of them. But I think it reinforces her feeling of
forget it, being forgotten.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, her solitude.
So now inspired by doing something new, like the doctor said, Vanessa decides to clean the house thoroughly. And she goes over every last square inch of this place because by the end of the episode, it looks like last season.
That's good.
Yeah, she needed to do that.
Yeah, I mean,
it's good for the soul for sure.
Yeah, it does feel good to do that. And especially since there was that large snail trail that was going down the hallway. Did you notice that in the opening?
I did.
You did too?
Yeah. And
like, what's that from?
I was trying to speculate that what that would be from. Just, I was thinking like the oil and grease and grit from the bottom of people's shoes as they're walking through the hallway.
Or whatever she's trekking through that she's not cleaning up.
She's just like rubbing her butt on the like a dog.
Like it's itching. Yeah.
Like a dog with an itchy butt just down the hallway.
Oh my goodness.
No wonder.
Yeah, it was definitely the cleaning montage. You know, it needed some 80s flair, some 80s music.
So her voiceover is her letter back to Malcolm Murray.
On the same day, October 6, 1892.
Yeah, on the very same day. And she admits to being basically depressed. She doesn't call it by that name, but that's, you know, she's been out of sorts and living in this unhealthy lethargy. Mm-hmm. And she's coming out of it, though, with a pretty good shot of optimism. And she sits at her window and she... I believe this is one of a line from one of Tennyson's poems when she says, in the end of it, she says, "Let all be well, be well."
Yeah, and it's cool that both her and Malcolm Murray are writing to each other on the same exact day. It's like they're far apart, but yet they're still connected. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so
and they're being really honest with each other. You know, there's no sugarcoating. They're just kind of like, okay, you know, this is what's going on with me.
Bearing all, yeah.
I really like that and respect that writing because I felt like there was, in the first two seasons, we would go two or three steps forward and then one step back with the character development as in regards to the relationships between these characters, how much they trusted each other, how much they would work together. So now I think all that is kind
of
in the past. Yeah, and it's set in motion now that everybody's going to be a certain way because we're all going to fight the big bads together once we get on the same page rather than being in a room and trying to be snarky to each other and stuff like that. That's all gone.
Yeah, well, I mean, they've been through a lot together, so it was nice to see it for sure.
So Dr. Seward's secretary takes Vanessa's 10 shillings that she dropped off with him and goes out to have some fun. And he finds a lady of the night who looks very, very uninterested in doing whatever it is that he wants to do. I haven't ever seen a more like uninterested sexual partner since I was in high school.
Yeah, he looked like a dog humping.
Well, I mean, yeah, there's her, but then there's him, which is like there was some definite violence that I was afraid of what it was going to develop into.
This guy is super
creepy. I almost
thought
he was going Jack the Ripper.
Yeah,
you know?
That's why I was like, oh, this is who this guy is. But
See, I didn't have a chance to think that far because once he started doing that stuff with her face, I was like, oh, this guy's a super creep. And then they get pulled apart violently and her head gets smashed onto the wall. You see the big bloom of blood and then he gets pulled into what looks like
darkness.
And it always happens in these abandoned old factories. You know, they're just the best settings. That's where most metal bands film their videos. You know, it's just what you do.
It's true.
Which is crazy that because like factories are still like actually relatively new because this is like Victorian period where all this is like taking off and there's already an abandoned one. Maybe it's just at night and all the workers are at home.
It could be. Yeah,
it was pretty run down though. I mean, it looked pretty run down.
It could have been the victim of a fire at some point. Because I know that the floor looked pretty messed up because you get a good shot of that with like all the rats and all of the little wannabe vampires scurrying around.
It could have been a storage area too, and that's why it looked that way, you know.
So they're pulled apart by a supernatural force and she dies instantly, like I said. He wakes up in what looks like an abandoned factory and he gets surrounded by the Death Ribbons duo. They kind of hem him in from both sides and he's like, oh, what the fuck is going on? And this is a great scene because it's a bait and switch because you think, oh, okay, these two are going to be bad guys and they're going to do something to this dude and then we're going to know that they're going to be a force to reckon with. It's just the beginning. So soon the whole place is crawling with similar goons and they close in on him and then it's almost like they're about to just attack him en masse and rip him up, like, because the lead guy is like, you are just pink with blood. And so you know they're vampires or at least aspiring vampires. And then they hear or sense something or perhaps both and they all drop to their knees instantly at the same time. And then they crawl away backwards like rats. I thought that was a really cool effect. Mm-hmm. Then the real monster appears, and we find out that this guy's name is Renfield. So we know who this is going to be right off the bat.
And so glorious.
So he says, you're going to go find out about Vanessa Ives, and you're going to report back to me. You're going to let me know everything you find, and you're going to give me your neck. And I mean, Em had mentioned this, how this actor has like the best scared face you've ever seen. He's just like contorted in horror.
Oh, yeah. He did an amazing job.
And so to end out the episode, he says, my name is Dracula. What yes. more could we have asked for from an episode of Penny Dreadful?
I don't think there's anything that I would want more.
Like right out of the gate, this was just insert whatever adjective, you know, insert whatever word you want in there to talk about how phenomenal it is. It's not going to be enough.
If this is like what we're in for this season, hooray.
That's how you write a great TV show. You just keep it going and going. Mm. It's an hour long and it feels like 15 minutes.
Yeah. I cannot wait for the rest of the season. You said 9 episodes?
I haven't verified that, but I remember when they had announced that they were renewed for season 3, that they had only put an order in for 9 episodes because that's all they need to tell this particular story. All right. Time for feedback.
Woohoo!
First up, Bib. Dear No Ship, I will make every effort to keep it short. Fasten your seatbelt.
Oh, did she just give me instruction to fasten?
She did.
I better do
click,
it.
Click, click.
I cheered when Patty's name came up in the credits. Who is making torts at Bond Manor? Oh, Ives, no. She just scratched her bum. How the mighty have fallen. So maybe, yeah, that lends credence to the snail trail. The bum snail trail. Lyle to the rescue. That is one amazing head of hair. Resplendently who I am. I love you, sir. Buffy is so lost without the rest of the Scoobies. That is an unfortunate haircut, Ethan Wolfe. So weird to see any of the cast. Ah, 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 what is she doing there in America? That was one hell of a train ride. I guess she spotted Hecate.
I know, right?
Ethan Wolfe, cousin to Dream Wolfe.
There is Vikings level location hopping going on. West Studi, damn good to see you. Old traditions die hard. Scalp in hand. Mohicans! Cannibals in the Arctic. Whoa, JC has a flashback. Good thing he's made of dead. That's a hell of a trek. Here's hoping the newly introduced POC live long and prosper. Ooh, Dr. Jekyll. Smashing.
Before we go on, when JC was walking in the Arctic, they should have had the like a little soundtrack to that. I would walk 500 miles. I would walk 500 more.
I liked how the ice that was crusting on his coat looked like a trim because it was like just right around the cuffs of his sleeves and his collar and right at the trim of his coat.
Could he freeze solid and still survive?
Maybe we'll see. Maybe right? He'll be slowly inching along.
That's how he gets across. He's in like a giant ice.
He starts cube. The legend of the abominable snowman.
Oh.
Right. Nice.
Bib goes on to say, I would like to give Ives a hug and a very large sandwich. Glad she's seeking assistance. Do you understand that you are ill? Not bad. Not unworthy. Just ill. Is it wrong that I'm into Junkie Xander? These two doctors have great chemistry. Kudos to the casting director.
They have great chemistry. The casting director is actually two casting directors. It's Frank and Nuala Mosel. I believe I'm pronouncing her first name correct. And they are actually the casting directors for Vikings as well.
Oh, wow. So they have skills.
Oh, for fuck's sake, says Bib. Why is Spike following Ives? Aw, Spike's way cooler than that guy.
You guys say
Slayo.
So.
I'm kidding.
Wolf love is everywhere. Another doctor? Somebody tell me this museum is real because it is glorious. All the broken and shunned creatures.
Now, Bib, don't act like you want to go there for the creatures. You want to go there for the doctor.
Honey, I appreciate you starting over, but you're rich. Hire someone to do the cleaning. That crossed my mind.
I mean, that is a good point.
Life without God, meh, the pot will help. Who is this duplicitous shit at the doctor's office? What in the fuck just happened? Hold up, is that Ivar the Boneless? Maybe it's just Cirque du Soleil. Oh, I suck at French. Okay. Ah, ha, ha, ha. Renfield, how awesome is that? Balls out. This show goes all in. Hell yeah.
See, Bib and I think alike. Balls references. Yeah. She held them out. I got kicked in them.
We're going to censor that, all of that.
Thanks, Bib.
Yeah, thank you, Bib.
All right, next up, Stephen Chandler. Hi, I'm Stephen Paul. Sweet baby cheeses, you guys, this show is back. We'll try to keep it short and sweet as requested. Amazing character developments for all of our dreadfuls, though I anticipate the onslaught of Lebrona and pretty boy Dorian. Big thumbs up on Dr. Clayton / Cutwife Link. That last scene slayed me. Finally, we get Dracula, Renfield's encounter with the nest, and then their master was utterly chilling, and I'm waiting with bated garlic breath for the big reveal. Could it be the mysterious Dr. Sweet is also king of the vampires? Hooray for making the vampires truly scary again. Called Dr. Jekyll's intro last season, but really looking forward to Hyde, making a hopeful call for the reappearance of Zombene, now he's buried in home soil. Looking forward to taking this ride with you again this season. Steve Chandler.
Zombene.
I kind of hope Zombene doesn't come back, just because it's going to make it less fearful for the rest of the characters. You know, you got to have some death, so that way you're scared for the characters you love. Not that I don't love the character. I just, you know, you got to have somebody get it every now and then to keep you on the edge of your seat.
I'm with you on that, because then you start to feel like the slate can be wiped clean at any time and we can reverse stuff. And it's just exactly. Like once you're dead, you're dead. So.
And now with this first episode has concluded, the timing would be kind of weird to all of a sudden have him kind of appear either out of the ground or in a mummy. Mm-hmm. I think in a mummy get up. I don't know. It would just be too clunky storytelling.
Yeah. Now they could bring him back if he's evil. You know, somebody brings him back and he's like a straight down villain to fuck with him. That would be okay.
Thanks, Steve Chandler. The other Steve, the other Chandler. All right. Next up, Dahlia General. Hi, M, Steve, and Paul. Yay! Penny Dreadful is back. I didn't think anything could get me over the emptiness of no more Vikings until fall, but immediately I was drawn back in. I forgot how much I freaking love these characters, and the addition of new characters. In a word, brilliant and seamless. Okay, that was three words, but I digress. Three quick notes. I noticed that the casting is done by the same team that does Vikings. No wonder the actors embodying the roles are so amazing. Props to the Moiselles. Best line of the episode goes to Lyle. I love what you've done with the place. I didn't connect Dr. Sweet to anything in terms of literature or meaning, but I do love how aptly named Dr. Seward's assistant Renfield is. If you didn't know, and you probably already did, clinical vampirism, or an obsession with drinking blood, is known as Renfield syndrome. Looking forward to more dreadful, gorgeous secrets unfolding next episode. Cheers, Dahlia General.
That's interesting. I would almost be willing to put up with drinking blood just to be legally diagnosed with Renfield syndrome.
Yeah.
Just to have that on your docket. And then
you're
just,
like, that's interesting. That's interesting about myself that I would be willing to do that.
And then you just stop. You know what I mean? Then you just stop. But it's on your permanent medical record. So like when you go to the doctor because you got like, you know, arthritis in your knee when you're like, you know, 60, and then it'd be like, so dude, you've got this, and this. Renfield syndrome. Yeah.
You're like, can I get...
Then you see them immediately strap extra gloves on like, this dude's nasty.
It was just a phase. It was just a phase, all right?
You say, can I get that documented and then certified? And then you're going to like hang it up.
Yeah, frame it.
Like people do with their...
Put it in...
Their degrees.
Is that a degree? No, it's a diagnosis. But it's still awesome. A
bloodsucker.
Yeah. Thank you, Dahlia.
Yeah, thank you.
Next up, Princess Butterqueen.
Oh, Butterqueen.
Hi, I'm Stephen Paul. So glad to have Penny Dreadful back for season 3. I absolutely loved this episode and would give it 10 out of 10 little scorpions. I especially enjoyed the scenes with Dr. Seward and Vanessa. The chemistry between the two characters is magical, and I can't wait to see how the connection between Seward's and Joan Clayton's backstories unfold. Yeah, and that's one thing, because I was thinking it when you were talking, but I forgot by the time, anyway, we got to that moment, but... the mention of the family name and stuff like that. And I thought Joan Clayton looked, you know, thoughtful when Ives left and maybe a little worried, you know. I've seen people online like describe her as a possible big bad or duplicitous, but I don't think that. I didn't get that. But why is Ives in a padded room later on in the season? So Maybe she is up to no good. Who knows? We'll see.
It's only ever going to go so far, because now that Dracula's pulling Renfield's strings and he is the secretary to Dr. Seward, then there you go.
There's no telling.
He's going to make sure that that only goes so far.
Or maybe he's somehow responsible. Maybe he sets Ives up for something, and I don't know.
I just don't know.
But anyway, so back to Princess Buttercream. She says, Vanessa's smile of pure joy when she saw the resemblance of Seward to the Cutwife was my favorite part. I was also touched by Lyle's empathy for Vanessa and his commitment to her. Eva Green's portrayal of a woman plunged into the depths of depression was spot on. Creepiest moment, the vampire / rats crawling down the chutes and ladders.
Chutes and ladders. Remember that game?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Thanks again for the great podcast, Princess Buttercream.
Thank you, Buttercream.
Thank you.
Thank you, Buttercream.
Feedback.
Feedback.
Next up, D. Cody. Good evening, M. Stephen Paul. Wow, I forgot how I missed and loved this show. The poetry adds layers to the bell tolling and imagery from start to finish. Tennyson's In Memoriam A.H.H. poem, "'Tis better to have loved and lost than never to have loved at all," that Lyle quoted to Vanessa was ingeniously picked up again by Dr. Sweet's Tooth and Claw and Gather Dust comments to Vanessa. This Tennyson's poem was originally titled The Way of the Soul and speaks of love, death, loss, hope, and humanity, which is Penny Dreadful through and through. I expect Tennyson will be with us all season long. This was almost a perfect episode, especially the way they use spoken letters and memories to reconnect our main Dreadful cast. Lyle is masterful in his role as he bridges both worlds for Vanessa. I could listen to him talk all night long. His words are carefully chosen and expertly delivered as he gently maneuvers Vanessa back to her next death challenge. In all sincerity, Lyle states, "Life, for all its anguish, is ours, Miss Ives." What he doesn't say is, "Death is not ours." It also struck me that Dr. Frankenstein was the only main character that asked for help, whereas Vanessa, Malcolm, Ethan, and John Clare had intervening circumstances to pull or push them away. Could this season be an end for Victor?
It goddamn better well not be. I'm not watching the show without Vicky. All right, well, I probably will, but I really hope that it's not the end for him. And D. Cody is absolutely spot on about Lyle. He should read books on tape or books on CD in that voice, in the Ferdinand Lyle voice. I could go to sleep to that.
It's
so comforting.
But so she feels that Frankenstein's the only character that asked for help.
He may have been the only one to verbally ask for help, but Vanessa was crying out for help, and Lyle was there to help her. I mean, he came over, he got her to the doctor, she was inspired, and so she got helped.
And Ethan needed help.
Yeah, Ethan
still does.
Ethan needed help. He's not, you know, he wasn't asking for any of it.
I like what she was saying about the poem. I wish I had looked up that poem now. It was hardly needed, but when I saw Patti LuPone enter the scene, I became the diehard Dreadful fanatic all over again. The potential twist of whether she is good or evil for Vanessa is fantastic. Of course, I will lean toward the Joan Clayton DNA pool gene to serve and protect Vanessa, but the Dr. Seward and Renfield combination and connection to Dracula make what's to come so exciting. There was hardly a hiccup in flow as the new characters came into scene. The potential of Dr. Sweet's skullduggery is right behind Dr. Seward's duplicity as my favorite new entry. After reading PH Double D's Project Fandom blog on Kaitane potential bid D role, I may consider my favoritism. I guess I must give up on the thought that Victor's mentor and hematologist friend, Professor Abraham Van Helsing, or John Clare's mentor and friend, Vincent, are Dracula. I know, they're dead, wrapped in plastic and all that.
You're finally getting it. All right. They're gone. They're done. When she says John Clare's mentor and friend Vincent, that's the guy from the Grand Guignol, right?
Yes. But she also mentions Van Helsing. She's saying either or.
So are you saying that Van Helsing or Vincent could possibly be Dracula? I can't see Van Helsing in a million years because his whole reason for being alive was to let people know that these demons existed and to hunt and kill them. And then John Clare had to go and pop his head off because he was still in his petulant emo teenage phase.
Yeah, he's dead unless they sewed his head back on and made him a Frankenstein.
And Vincent. Not that it's really any argument against it, but he just seemed too kind.
Yeah, I agree.
Just for the record, I want to go on record as saying that I don't think that Dr. Sweet, Vincent, or Van Helsing, or anybody else is Dracula. I think Dracula is too powerful to need to do that. These characters are other characters that are spinning their own wheels and parts of the story. I think Dracula is just the master behind it all. He's the op.
Yeah, because if he could do that, then why would he need Renfield? He would just be going and collecting all the information he needed anyway. So it would take away from him actually needing Renfield. So I don't think we've seen the character yet. I mean, we could have, but I really don't. I think it's going to be a reveal. I mean, exactly like Steve said, you know, he's too powerful to need to do that. He just has Renfield and goons. He's got the goon squad out there doing it all for him.
D. Cody goes on to say, though nonsensical, I've wondered if JC is one of the fallen brothers since he spiritually feeds on the dead poet's souls of wonder. I'm hoping to see John Clare return to protect Vanessa, but he most likely will end Victor's suffering. Regardless, all prospects of blood tingling, and for a moment, it was nice to see Vanessa in awe and smiling. Too many thoughts. I'm sure you and others will provide insight to quench my remaining thirst. Overall, IV drips, 9.5.
I like that. We've got three really good rating systems going on here. Because Dunkin' Donuts is going to bring up one too. But we have Little Scorpions, IV drips, and then Donuts is one. So we're going to, I don't know, I think we should just use them all interchangeably.
I think, you just whatever you want to make it at this point. Everybody has their own. It's all the same scale, just a different name.
If you have time, can you speculate on these questions? Vampire Thrall, can you remind me how a vampire and his young sidekick can be in sunlight, even if it's in the London Grey?
Well, Dracula wasn't. I mean, that was pretty much devoid of sunlight. And the goon squad, there might not be full vampires. You know, he might just be giving them a little taste so they can go out into daylight and protect them.
Yeah, that's what thralls are. Because it's the promise it's like the reward down the road that you will eventually be made vampire.
They're becoming that. So that's part of what a thrall is. And like these two just said, they're able to do the minion type work and go out there and do that. And to be able to do that, you have to be able to walk around whatever city you're in sunlight. But you know, they even commented, the kid commented on how he looks like he has anemia. It's something in the blood. And so they're slowly getting to the point where they're not going to be able to be out in sun at all. But
now, then again, a lot of people have taken liberties on vampires, unfortunately, in the last 10 years. So hopefully we kind of get a return to the scary monster version, because the sparkly,
that's
annoying ones just need to
There's been a lot of different permutations on the vampire mythology, like what can and what can't happen. But that particular one in general kind of sticks in my craw.
It all kind of started with Anne Rice. I think she started...
You're right. You're absolutely right. Anne Rice is a great writer, and I like some of those vampire books, and I like some of her other work, and I'm not knocking her, but she is directly responsible for Twilight.
She also wants us to speculate on Rusk is keen. Do you think his cup of tea request to get him out of Ethan's boxcar was coincidence or careful risk management on his part?
Oh, it was coincidence.
It's plot device all day long, but it works beautifully, so there's nothing to criticize about it.
Yeah, no, not at all. Definitely coincidence, because Rusk, as a character, wouldn't give his prey away. He would at least fight to keep him there.
Yeah, because he looks bad. He's got him all the way to America just to lose him, so.
Yeah, just to have all of his men slaughtered.
Yeah.
Thanks.
D. Cody says, thanks, onward charge, the Light Brigade.
Now, do we get a Rusk Hecate joining up? You know, like... Maybe she does a little voodoo. I don't know.
Maybe.
I mean, together to get him.
If she's mesmerizing him in some way, possibly. But I see her working alone at this point. I don't know if that's because of the previews I've seen. But
see, I haven't watched any. I've gone into this cold turkey.
Well, you remember, Rusk has a Count Odo hand, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does.
So I don't know.
He might not be long for this world.
I don't really know what that could possibly signify, but...
The Iron Hand of Rusk.
All right, we are now to our final piece of feedback. We've got Dunkin' Donuts. Hey, hey, no shippers. Going to have to resort to bib-style bullet points to control the length. First of all, I loved it. Penny D is back, y'all. I watched it 5 times, and I'm going to watch it 5 more. 9 out of 10 pennies.
Nice.
All of the new people are magnetic and perfectly paired, and every setting looks amazing. I felt the grit and dust and humidity and slime. I could tell exactly what the museum smelled like and how Vanessa must be longing to touch everything. Bravo, Penny D. The wolf caged and inanimate. Ethan, right now. Sweet's use of bloodless and albino, foreshadowing vampires versus the tooth and claw of the dreadfuls.
Ooh.
Sweet, is he already, or will he become the embodiment of Dracula? There were so many parallels drawn between Victor and Vanessa this episode that there must be a sinister side to her partner. Hecate's wearing white, using her magic for a good cause. Dr. Seward introduces Jungian psychiatry 30 years early with the Ouroboros. Last season, we explored the circular conflict of the scorpion, the hound, and the devil. This season, it is a singular being, a focus on inner conflict. The pairing of two monstrous men in Frankenstein and Jekyll. Frankenstein has had no equal in the group until now, and their potential together is genuinely scary. When Jekyll started talking about Lily, I was alternately repulsed and cheering, "Yes, do it! Try it!"
Let's make this work.
Victor's still using that chipped teacup of his sanity. Ah, that was nice. I like that. The text of JC's song sums up the mission of the Dreadfuls. Huh. I need to go back and pay attention to that.
I know.
Vanessa quotes from Tennyson's Maud in her final scene. Interesting choice, as it tells of a lover obsessed with a hauntingly beautiful woman who he's falsely convinced is summoning him. She does join him in a momentary flirtation, but her brother disapproves and dies defending her honor in a duel with the narrator, who flees. Maud dies of a broken heart, and the narrator goes mad, eventually joining the Crimean War, a debacle without a definitive end. In short, the devil and Dracula's circular obsession with Vanessa, and it suggests that one or more of the dreadful men will be killed by Dracula. No. Deep sea fish feeding on volcanic gases to produce their own light equals a symbol of the dreadfuls feeding their fight with hell and darkness to create goodness. But they also need that evil and darkness to live, and will keep following this path, as Kaitane prophesies of Malcolm, until their death. Let me know if it was too long, Dr. D's. Now, this is just right.
No, yeah, yes. These were fine. I mean, we didn't want you guys to just write two sentences or anything like that. Yeah. It was just we just couldn't do the all things style. That's all.
Yeah, no, good job to everybody. I mean, it was some really enjoyable feedback. It was fun. A lot of good points. I'm going to have to go back and rewatch, like Em said, and go back and listen to his song even more. I was too busy looking at everything else. So it just shows you how, and everybody loved the episode. We didn't have anybody kind of bringing it down, so it shows you how fantastic it was.
I'm gonna have to read up on some Tennyson and really pay attention. I think D. Cody's right. I think we're gonna see more of his poetry this season.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we're definitely doing another contest this season. As always, you know, I've got a piece in the works. Actually, a couple. So what we're gonna do is I'm gonna post it on Twitter, and when it does go up, we're gonna do instead of the usual, how we kind of take points on everything you can do, we're going to do the drawing again off of our feedback on iTunes. So all you have to do is put it in. We're going to pull at the end of the season when we do our bonus podcast. So soon I'll have it up. I'm thinking 2 weeks I should have the firing done, you know, the high fire with the glaze and everything. And if I like it, I'll put it up. If I don't, then I'll make another one. So cross your fingers.
I saw a picture of his chalice that he made for Penny Dreadful this season. It is amazing.
Yeah. Thank you.
It's the best piece of work I've seen you make.
Awesome. Thank you. I've been on a roll lately. It's really good.
Yeah, so it looks seriously
hopefully
impressive.
Hopefully it keeps going.
You definitely want this, especially if all you have to do is participate in the contest. It's
right. Right. So it's exciting. I mean, we've got a lot of things in the works coming. You know, we're not going to announce them all, but, you know, thanks again to everybody who made our Vikings first half of the season so successful. And, of course, everybody that listens, we appreciate you.
All right. Well, thank you, everybody, for your emails. And that's it.
All right. Till next week, by the pricking of our thumbs,
something wicked this way comes.
I would have gotten that one. I'm just saying I would have gotten it.
I'm your host, Steve.
I'm your host, Paul.
And my name is Dracula.